Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
This year marks the 40th anniversary of the United States Olympic hockey team's victory over the Soviet Union in the Olympic Games in Lake Placid in the midst of the Cold War back in 1980. The United States went on to beat Finland to win the gold, and I'm joined by a journalist who was there to cover it all, John Gilbert, and his new book is Miracle in Lake Placid, the greatest hockey story ever told. John, we all have our memories from the final moments of that game against the Soviet Union. You were in the press box. What was the emotion like for you in the press box as you covered it for the Minneapolis Tribune?
Well, I'll tell you, it was a very interesting experience because I was groomed to be objective no matter what, no matter how much I wanted one team to win in the Stanley Cup Finals or the Minnesota State High School Tournament, whatever. I was groomed to not show any emotion and to be very objective. And at the start of those games, you know, there's only a few people in the press box and actually only a few people in the arena. Nobody expected much out of that team, and they tied Sweden in that first game, kind of shocked everyone. But by the end, it was the cause célèbre for all the journalists, all the people that were there to cover ski jumping or speed skating. Everyone who could get a credential was crammed into that press box, and as we sat there, I'm watching it, and I was really tight. If someone came up and tapped me, I probably would have shattered into a million pieces. But everybody else in the press box, it actually was embarrassing at the time, and even now, these people were cheering and jumping up and down and yelling, and it was amazing. It was a press box that had no decorum, and I was sitting there quietly in an assigned seat, and next to me was a fellow from Switzerland who became a big part of my story and all that, but he was a coach of the team over in Lugano, but also a journalist, and so he was covering it, and in his kind of broken German English, he spoke well, but he was saying these little things to me along the side, and they were like, don't disturb me, but I didn't want to stop him because he was saying these wonderful things. But I have to tell you, the rest of the press box was jubilant and cheering and yelling, and could not hold themselves back. And I was proud of myself because I sat there rigid, without any emotion and just having it all bottled up inside of me. But it was fantastic to witness. And as the closing minutes came along, I was like, don't do anything I'm not superstitious, but don't do anything to foul this up, you know? So when this fellow was saying these little pearls, I couldn't help but write him down. I wanted him to keep talking, but I didn't want him to talk at all, if you know what I mean. I wanted to sit there in my own little self-imposed isolation and witness this event because there was certainly a great chance by then that they could pull it off.
Were you at the exhibition game at Madison Square Garden with the Russians a few days before the game, we all remember?
Yes, I was. That was also fantastic. Actually, I'd covered that team through the whole season, from the time Herb Brooks picked the team out in Colorado Springs the previous summer, and then all through they trained at Met Sports Center in Bloomington, right outside of Minneapolis, where the North Stars played. And so I covered all the levels of hockey, but in my coverage, I would, whenever they played home, I would go out there and cover the game, and I would go out often and watch their practices because I had covered Herb Brooks through his all 7 years he coached at the University of Minnesota, and he and I talked guardedly off to the side often about what he believed in hockey, what I liked about hockey, and we became very close friends because of that. But I watched this team through the whole thing, so I knew every player, and I treasured that relationship because they trusted me. Certainly all the guys who were from Minnesota, I had covered them since they were in high school, then in college, and then on that team. And that was a dozen of them. And then through the college games with Mark Johnson and, Mark Wells and Ken Morrow from Michigan and even Mike Ruzioni from BU and Jim Craig and Dave Silks and Jack O'Callaghan, I had covered them all. I didn't know them very well, but I got to know them during that season of exhibitions. And I really appreciated the fact that they trusted me, so they would confide in me knowing I wouldn't divulge it if it was off the record, So I had this great rapport with them, and And so by the time we got to the lake, to Madison Square Garden, I had been there covering the Rangers and the North Stars, of course, several times. And I had been there the previous year when they played this best-of-three series against the Russian team, the Soviet Union's best team. The NHL decided, instead of an all-star game, to play one all-star team to play a three-game series against the Russians in Madison Square Garden. And at that time, you're right, the Cold War was raging, but people didn't trust anything that had Russia or Soviet Union attached to it. So there was this hatred before they even saw these guys. I had watched them play in previous international tournaments, and I knew what magnificent players they were. So the NHL beat them the first game, but it was actually a really badly ref game where they stuck the Russians. Every time they came near somebody, they gave them a penalty. And then the second game, they overcame that and won the game, the Russians did. So it was tied 1-1 going into game three. And in that game, with everything mustered up, the greatest NHL team ever assembled, perhaps, the Soviets beat them 6-0. So that was the team that now the young college kids were going to play at Madison Square Garden. And it was amazing. Herb Brooks, after the game, said, I made a mistake. I gave him too cautious of a forechecking scheme. I said, well, you made a mistake. You didn't bring your own puck. And that game was unbelievable. And one of the great parts of that game, it was 10-3. The Soviets beat them, and the U.S. got a couple goals late to make it closer than it probably should have been. But in that game, Maltsev came down 90 miles an hour on David Christian retreating on defense, and he's been a center all his life and was after that. He's converted to defense by Brooks because Brooks loved to have defensemen who were quick and smart and agile and good with the puck. So here's David Christian retreating, and this Alexander Maltsev comes in 90 miles an hour at him, did a little inside deke, and then did like a pirouette, slipped the puck by him, landed and scored on the backhand all in one motion. And it was absolutely eye-popping. So after the game, the press conference, Herb Brooks said to all the gathered New York media, he said, I knew we were in trouble when they introduced the Russian players before the game and my players applauded. No, he wasn't being accurate, but it was a great line. And everybody laughed, and he had the whole crowd following him. And then he said, and then Maltsev scored that goal, and I applauded. So it was really something, because the U.S. guy said they'd never seen puck handling like that. They'd never seen anything approaching that. And that also was a key part. I've read a couple accounts later, books about it, where people said they think that Brooks was so in control that he actually convinced his players to throw that game to set up a future rematch. That is totally absurd. Even suggesting it means you don't understand hockey, because there was no way the U.S. team didn't play its absolute best, and they got completely outmanned.
I'm chatting with John Gilbert about his brand new book, Miracle in Lake Placid, The Greatest Hockey Story Ever Told. John, did the players at the time, I mean, this game was played in the heels of President Jimmy Carter announcing that the U.S. would boycott the 1980 Summer Olympics. So did the players at the time view this game as some microcosm of a battle between two world powers?
You know, they really did not. They went up there into their little Olympic village, which I think later was turned into a minimum security prison, and they were like, cloistered away of this, and they were so focused from this whole, you know, 9 months of training they'd gone through, and they were so focused on just the next game. If West Germany had been undefeated, that would have been the big game, but this was the Soviet team that had won all these Olympic games in a row and had not lost in so many games. It was the most invincible powerhouse team ever. But for these players, it was just hockey. I mean, some of the players admitted to me, even today, will admit to me that, you know, they didn't understand the magnitude of the event, because they didn't really have any way. There wasn't like CNN you could watch every day, or, you know, you didn't get hot news about the world situation or about the hostages in Iran or anything. It was all they were focused on was their hockey and their play and what they had to do and who their next opponent was, and it was building up to this game. So the game itself was that was enough. You know what I mean? It's kind of as if you were facing the New York Yankees in their heyday in a baseball team, and you're playing them in the World Series, and after you beat them, someone said, did you know that every one of the Yankees was a communist? No, you didn't have any idea that baseball was imposing enough for you to take on. And that's the way that hockey was. So the players now are almost apologetic and saying that we really didn't know how big a deal it was. And I had an interesting thing, because when Jimmy Carter declared the U.S. would not go to Moscow for the Olympics that summer, Herb Brooks said, I support him 100%. And I had a big debate with Herb about that, because I said, you know, Herb, what if he said, we're so mad at him, we're not going to even participate in our own Olympic hockey right now? Then would you support him 100%? I said, the people that are going to those Olympics in the summer have trained, some of them, all their lives for this moment, and now it's being pulled out from under them by a political maneuver. And I was a big supporter of Jimmy Carter, too, but I thought that was out of line. And to me, sports might have been a way to get around that, or to get past that, or even to conquer that, and to show the rest of the world that we're not such bad people, and maybe they aren't either. You know, so that was interesting, because, as I say, Herb supported it, and I said, well, if it affected this team going to Lake Placid, you might not have been so supportive.
Something that I think gets lost in remembering this story is what the U.S. victory did for the NHL. How important was it?
Well, you know, it was really important. I grew up in Duluth, Minnesota, and my father played for the Brooklyn Dodgers, actually, in the end of Duluth Eskimos back in the late 20s, and long before he got married and I was born. But, you know, I know all I had to know growing up about baseball, football, and basketball, and I played baseball and ran amateur teams right up into my 70s, actually, and so I never stopped loving the game. But in hockey, in Minnesota, John Marucci coached the University of Minnesota, and he had played with the old Chicago Blackhawks back in the 40s when there were no Americans playing in the NHL, and he did. He was a tough, tough character. And he coached Herb Brooks at the University of Minnesota. And his stance was, we're not going to ever get any better than... It actually was similar to Anatoly Tarasov in the Soviet Union. He said, we're not going to get better and establish our own identity in hockey in Minnesota unless we support our own players. So at that time in college hockey, the National Hockey League draft was 20 years old. In other words, you could play junior hockey until you were 20. And at that point, you're playing 80 games a year. And in Minnesota high schools, you're playing 16 games a year. And so when you got age 20 playing Canadian junior, you went through the NHL draft. If you got drafted, you signed a pro contract. If you didn't get drafted, you might go to a U.S. college on a full scholarship as a 21-year-old freshman. So Michigan Tech, Denver, North Dakota, Colorado College, they all had 21-year-old freshmen, which means they were 25-year-old seniors. And the University of Minnesota had almost entirely Minnesota high school kids. There was no junior hockey in Minnesota at the time, so you played high school, and at age 18 or 19, you went to college. So here these guys, the University of Minnesota had never won a national championship, but how could they? They had some seniors who were younger than the freshmen on those powerhouse Michigan and Michigan Tech and North Dakota teams in Denver. Those teams won all the national championships. So that was his stance, was to make the Minnesota hockey that much better, but the National Hockey League ignored those guys. In fact, there was a point when I first started writing where a fellow named Tommy Williams from Duluth, Minnesota, was the only American in the National Hockey League. And he had only made it because his dad had a big battle with the high school league in Minnesota, and he sent his kid off to Canada to play junior hockey rather than to go to high school here. So the NHL thought he was okay, so they took him, and he played, had a nice career. But at any rate, when Herb Brooks came along, he wins his the first three national championships that Minnesota ever won. And I said, now that was a miracle, because he did it with all Minnesota kids, beating all these, you know, graybeard Canadian players and the other colleges. So what happened when the 80 Olympics came along was suddenly it was like a one-way ticket from every NHL city to Minnesota. They had just expanded, you know, in 67, so it wasn't long before that they had expanded from 6 to 12 teams. And all of the teams suddenly wanted to scout these Minnesota guys. They thought, if they're that good, we should be getting them. And then suddenly the top Minnesota players got a chance to play in the National Hockey League. And that led to, you know, there are only a few like Reed Larson and just a few that made it before. And so now there was a sudden surge of Minnesota-born players that got a chance to play in the National Hockey League. And that led to what we have now, this tremendous growth throughout the country, all germinated by Minnesota. And now that the USA Hockey has a great development program that Brooks, you know, contributed greatly to. And so that's really what that did. That was the breakthrough that, you know, some of those guys didn't really make it. You know, Mike Ramsey and Neil Broughton were the two youngest players on the U.S. team. They were both 19 years old and when they played in the 80 Olympics. And so, you know, you imagine they're playing against these old Europeans, including the Soviets. Some of them were in their 30s, but they were phenomenal players. Some of them also were young. They have the whole span. But these guys, you know, Mike Ramsey, after the Olympics were over, went right after his freshman year at Minnesota. He played on the Olympic team. He was a great defenseman, young, agile, tough, rangy, could skate, could do everything. He went to the Buffalo Sabres. Scotty Bowman drafted him. And he had, like, a wonderful career. He played a long career, and then he ended up coaching for years afterwards. But there's a case where he would never have gotten a look from the National Hockey League if it wasn't for that 80 Olympic team. Neil Broughton the same way. He went right into the first-round draft pick of the North Stars. He had a phenomenal career. You know, when the North Stars left town, he was the biggest reason people were sorrowful. So he and Mike Madonna went to Dallas with the Dallas Stars. And so that was a tremendous breakthrough for USA Hockey completely, but for Minnesota Hockey, it put it on the map. And we get to be close family friends, my wife Joan and I, with a couple of guys who we didn't know from anyone, but they were scouts who came here and were referenced to look us up, and we got to be really good friends with them. And they were here only to try and look for talent among the Minnesota high school players.
It's just an amazing story to hear in an account that somebody that was there for this and has really been in the front row of this whole story. The book is Miracle in Lake Placid, The Greatest Hockey Story Ever Told by John Gilbert. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold. And on this 40th anniversary of that memorable game, it's a great time to check it out. It's a very good read. John, thanks so much for sharing this story that you've had brewing inside you for 40 years, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, you know, the one other point is that when Brooks wouldn't talk to the media, he still talked to me in private sessions after each game. And after I talked to him for a half an hour after each game, I went outside and talked to the players as they came out the door. None of the other media people knew them. I knew all of them, so I could talk to all of them. And I have quotes from them that never got used, because you can only use a few quotes in your game story. So all of those quotes, spontaneous and yet unused, are in this book. That's what makes it so special.
Oh, it was just a great read. John, thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.